Participants and attendees from four different lodges are here from Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, and London, Canada. And we're glad that we could all get together on this happy occasion. The format for the meeting is as follows. There'll be a short talk on the life and work of Robert Crosby. There'll be several readings then, and then a talk on ULT, and then a reading of the Declaration. That will be the formal part of the meeting, and then informally we'll have a few announcements and an opportunity for us to share favorite quotations from Robert Crosby or to express our feelings about ULT and Mr. Crosby. So we will begin with a short talk on the life and work of Robert Crosby by a student from the New York Lodge.
Are you ready? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome. Okay. All right. Robert Crosby was the main founder of the United Lodge of Theosophists in 1909. Okay. And Robert Crosby was born on January 10th, 1849, in Montreal, Canada. Both his parents were connected with the Hudson Bay Company. In 1865, Crosby, raised a Presbyterian, was invited to join the communion. As he said, he considered himself still unfit. Subsequent discussions caused him to doubt that church's practices. He determined to independently find the truth, which must be knowledge, and adopted a practice of constant questioning into life's objects, pain, sickness, death, mercy, justice, fate. He found that the religions around him offered no satisfactory answers when he questioned them deeply. From his earliest years, he was deeply interested in religious, philosophical, and occult subjects. That was from Theosophy Magazine, Volume 7, page 320. The psychic powers latent in man, hypnotism, mesmerism, clairvoyance, and telepathy were seen by him to exist, but their rationale was still to be understood. He sensed that there was danger in those and also sensed that he was receiving some guidance, which later he said helped him avoid unconscious black magic practices. Crosby always had a strong regard for the rights of others and always exercised a strong moral control over himself. Selling their business in Montreal, Crosby and his partner went to Boston and started another shoe and leather manufacturing business. It became well known and was highly respected. In 1888, he heard of the proposed establishment of a branch of the Theosophical Society in Boston. As the word Theosophia suggested much to him, Crosby went to the first meeting. He recognized at once that this was what he was searching for, and he joined the Theosophical Society immediately. He was admitted on June 5th, 1888. Soon after, Mr. William Q. Judge came to Boston to speak at the branch of the TS, and Crosby was introduced to him together with other members. After the meeting, leaving for his hotel, Judge called back to Crosby, "Good night, Crosby. I've got you on my list. Mr. Crosby recorded. A veil was lifted, a tie was formed, which has never since been broken. Crosby was elected secretary of the Boston branch of the Theosophical Society. Mr. Griggs was its president. On Mr. Griggs' retirement, he was made the president of the Boston branch. He helped organize the 8th convention of the American section of the TS in Boston around April 28th or 29th of 1895. It was during this convention that the American section passed resolutions that transformed it into the Theosophical Society in America, giving it full legal autonomy. On page 24 of the report for the convention, we find Mr. Judge stating in an article, "The basis for fraternal affiliation, which unites all theosophical working bodies and theosophists together. The unity of the theosophical movement does not depend upon the singleness of organizations, but upon the similarity of work and aspiration. And in this, we will keep the link unbroken." Along with Mr. Wade and Mr. Ayers, Mr. Crosby submitted to the convention an historical sketch of the TS. This traced the major events of its existence and work in America since 1875. And this was included in the proceedings and report issued by the convention. Later, a pamphlet embodying this information was issued under the title, "What is the Theosophical Organization?" During this period, Mr. Judge was attacked, exonerated, and later persecuted again by the chief officers of the TS outside of America. So, these two officers, it appears, to have understood that Mr. Judge and Mr. Crosby in Boston stood primarily for theosophy, as HPB did, and not only for the TS. To them, the Theosophical Society was a useful tool to be sustained as a promulgating body for the doctrines of theosophy. Mr. Crosby supported Mr. Judge's principles fully. He acted as one of the witnesses on the scene. He kept the link of pure theosophy unbroken after Judge's death. Okay, so now, Mr. Crosby in Boston was in cordial relations with Mrs. Tingley, who had been placed shortly after Mr. Judge's death in the position of the head of the TS in America. In reviewing this period, Mr. Crosby wrote, "I was in Boston and had no reason to doubt the statements coming from New York, whom I believed to be sincere and of good training and judgment. So I should have known by other means the true state of affairs when Judge passed out of life. I lost touch with him. Doubtless, I relied on him too much and had not exercised my own intuition. From later events, my comprehension is that this loss of touch was purposely done in order that I might strengthen my weakness in that direction. I went to Point Loma at Mrs. Tingley's urgent request to assist in the proposed work and was there for 2 years, helping to prepare the way for the expected developments before I began to get back the touch I had lost. I am prone to excuse inconsistencies and deviations in others, so that although I had begun to doubt and to see, It was more than a year afterwards, I saw so clearly and unmistakably that I took occasion to tell Mrs. T the facts as I saw them, and to state my intention to withdraw from all connection with her. She tried, of course, in every way to change my determination, but finding me unchangeable, she let me go. And as I afterwards heard, gave out that she had sent me away for bad conduct, but just for what, I do not know. That's from autobiographical notes by Robert Crosby. Mr. Crosby married his second wife, Josephine Parsons, on April 10th, 1900, in Manchester, New Hampshire. They had two children, a daughter named Kathleen and a son, Cameron. Mr. Crosby was summoned by Mrs. Tingley to take up residence in Point Loma, outside of San Diego, California, where a headquarters had been located for the Theosophical Society in America, now renamed Universal Brotherhood and the Theosophical Society. Mr. Crosby noted that he had been active in theosophical matters in Boston for some 14 years. He went there with Mrs. Crosby and was required then, on taking up residence, to turn over all their assets to the organization. Conflicting reports were circulated from the Point Loma organization as to why Mr. and Mrs. Crosby left the Point Loma establishment. None of the family assets which he turned over at the time of entry were returned to him. He and Mrs. Crosby, when they left, were left penniless. Mr. and Mrs. Crosby found a house to rent in South Pasadena. He secured a job as a bookkeeper with the Los Angeles Times. This work was arduous and required long hours standing and was not well paid. Like many others, he rode the streetcars to work. Mr. Crosby became acquainted with his neighbors in South Pasadena. He found that they were interested in theosophical ideas, and with their joint interest in a study class in theosophy was started, using Mr. Judge's The Ocean of Theosophy and Madame Blavatsky's The Key to Theosophy as the first text to be studied, and also the Bhagavad Gita, the Theosophy of 5,000 years ago. Robert Crosby preserved unbroken the link of the second section of the Theosophical movement from the passing of Mr. Judge in 1896 and 1907, just 11 years later, made that link once more fair square, foursquare amongst men. In the year 1909, the third section was restored by the formation of the United Lodge of Theosophists. In 1912, he founded the magazine Theosophy. Organized theosophical meetings were first held by Mr. Crosby under a charter obtained from the TS in America that E.T. Hargrove had reformed. After splitting away from the Point Loma TS in New York, 1898 or 9, they had attracted a number of Mr. Judge's earlier companions, including Dr. A. Keitley and his wife Julia, better known as Jasper Nemand. A year later, this Theosophical Society in America decided to change their appellation back to the Theosophical Society. Since this was considered injudicious, some in the LA branch rejected the change. Mr. Crosby and seven others decided to organize on their own, adopting the original principles and the original program of the masters, which HBB and Mr. Judge had embodied practically during their lifetime. These principles are to be found in the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. November 17th, 1908, Mr. Crosby issued an announcement to all open-minded Theosophists. This can be found in Theosophy, Volume 24, page 341, and The Friendly Philosopher by Robert Crosby. February 18th, 1909, the United Lodge of Theosophists, or ULT, was launched. The Declaration is its only basis. An initial explanatory statement will be found in Theosophy, Volume 23, page 337, and The Friendly Philosopher, pages 412 to 14. No formal bond existed among the associates of the ULT, the sole object being the study and dissemination of theosophy pure and simple. Okay, so the semi-esoteric character of the ULT was a phrase that Mr. Crosby used. He also said that the ULT had to do work which the various theosophical societies then in existence had all failed in. It had to work to restore the integrity of the original impulse as laid down by masters through HPB. Crosby stressed impersonality and anonymity to protect the work and to help protect the workers from pride and ambition. It was recorded that in his work, Mr. Crosby was undeviating. As regards himself and family, Mr. Crosby was always well dressed in public, at work, and at the lodge rooms, so that theosophy might not be rated on a poor personal appearance. He made a point of this to all those who worked at ULT. In the beginning, in The Friendly Philosopher, letters were written by Mr. Crosby to early students at various ULT lodges out of the San Francisco and other areas. These few letters concern themselves with the principles on which the ULT was established. Impersonality, conferencing together on decisions affecting the operations of a lodge, and a direct approach to the actual teachings of HPB and William Q. Judge were stressed again and again. November 1912, Theosophy magazine was founded. Mr. Crosby serving as chief editor until his death in 1919. In 1912, the midpoint of the second quarter of the movement, the magazine Theosophy was founded to provide a medium for dealing with theosophical philosophy and history free from sectarian affiliations or influences. Slowly, the effort spread despite all obstacles and opposition, the impregnable basis of impersonal devotion, keeping the work unsullied, and impersonality strictly continued after the death of Mr. Crosby in 1919. Theosophy magazine, in its second volume, started to publish a series of articles on theosophical history under the title Masters and Their Message. This historical review of the events and the documents of the modern theosophical movement forms the basis for the book, later published under the title The Theosophical Movement, 1875 to 1925, edited by Mr. Crosby. Theosophy School was started. This activity was adopted and implemented by most ULTs as they became established. Mr. Crosby's burdens during many years have been enormous. In addition to his other work, he was a frequent speaker at the meetings of the United Lodge. He was constantly at the service of the hundreds of students who sought his wise and benign counsels in their many problems. He attended personally, under no matter what pressures upon his time and energies, to an incessant stream of correspondence from unknown inquirers who came in some unknown ways to learn of him and to seek his kindly advice and suggestion. He never denied his help, but gave freely, without stint or limit. Worn out in these unselfish labors for the benefit and advantage of his fellow men, burdened with the toll of advancing toll years, The frail body could no more sustain the increasing demands upon it. He died as he had lived, calm and serene, with no word of complaint during the days of intense suffering that preceded his release. Something of his firm principles and the impersonality of his life and work can be gained from reading his article in Theosophy magazine, Is Theosophy a Progressive System of Religion? On June 25th, 1919, Mr. Crosby died. It is valuable to note that HBB's last article was My Books, published in Lucifer magazine for April 1891. It is a resume evidencing the nature of her writings as the recorded teachings of the Masters of Wisdom. In April 1896, Mr. Judge's last article appeared in the Path Theosophy. HBB was not deserted by masters. It is his statement confirming his belief in the reliability of HBB, the messenger. Mr. Crosby's last article is Theosophy, a Progressive System of Religion, in magazine Theosophy, July of 1919, reiterates the position that Theosophy is not a constantly changing set of ideas, but a consistent and complete body of knowledge to be studied, applied, and promulgated as originally presented. Following the principles of the ULT Declaration, neither Mr. Crosby nor any student of the ULT has made any claim to be a successor, leader, or teacher. Each student and inquirer has been carefully put into direct touch with HBBR teacher through her writings, original and unchanged. Each has been encouraged to study, work for Theosophy, and practice that universal brotherhood, which forms the basis of all nature. Mr. Judge's writings have been selected for study and reproduction because they most faithfully and carefully follow and supplement Madame Blavatsky's writings, and all students are encouraged to prove this for themselves. So some of the works by Mr. Crosby, The Friendly Philosopher, Answers to Questions on the Oceans of Theosophy, The Theosophical Movement, Because for Children Who Ask Why, Universal Theosophy, a reprint of selected talks and letters by Mr. Crosby culled from The Friendly Philosopher. Okay, so I think with that, I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So the three people we heard about a lot here, H.P. Blavatsky, William Q. Judge, and Robert Crosby, we're now going to hear from them in their own words in three readings that we're now going to hear. The first one is from the writings of H.P. Blavatsky, H.P.B., on Theosophy. And this will be read by a student from the Washington, D.C. Lodge.
Great. From the writings of H.P.B. Blavatsky, Theosophy is the archaic wisdom religion, the esoteric doctrine once known in every ancient country having claims to civilization. This wisdom, all the old writings show us as an emanation of the divine principle, and the clear comprehension of it is typified in such names as the Indian Buddha, the Babylonian Nebo, the Thoth of Memphis, the Hermes of Greece, in the appellations also of some goddesses, Metis, Neitha, Athena, the Gnostic Sophia, and finally the Vedas, from the world to know. The central idea was that of a single supreme essence, unknown and unknownable. For how could one know the knower, as inquires the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad? Theosophy is belief in the deity as the all, the source of all existence, the infinite that cannot be either comprehended or known. the universe alone revealing it. True theosophy shrinks from brutal materialization. It prefers believing that from eternity retired within itself, the spirit of the deity neither wills nor creates, but that from the infinite effulgency, everywhere going forth from the great center, that which produces all visible and invisible things, is but a ray containing in itself the generative and conceptive power, which in its turn produces that which the Greeks called macrocosm, the Kabbalists Tikkun or Adam Kadmon, the archetypal man, and the Aryans Purusha, the manifested Brahm, or the divine male. Theosophy believes also in the anastasis or continued existence, and in transmigration, evolution, or a series of changes in the soul which can be defended and explained on strict philosophical principles, and only by making a distinction between Paramatma, transcendental supreme soul, and Jivatma, animal or conscious soul, of the Vedantins. To fully define theosophy, we must consider it under all its aspects. The interior world has not been hidden from all by impenetrable darkness. But that higher intuition acquired by theosophia, or God knowledge, which carried the mind from the world of form into that formless spirit. Man has been sometimes enabled in every age and every country to perceive things in the interior or invisible world. Hence the samadhi or dhyan yoga samadhi of the Hindu ascetics, the daimonian poti or spiritual illumination of the Neoplatonists, the sidereal confabulation of soul of the Rosicrucians or fire philosophers, and even the ecstatic trance of mystics and of the modern mesmerisms and spiritualists are identical in nature, so various as to manifestation. The search after man's diviner self, so often and so erroneously interpreted as individual communion with a personal God, was the object of every mystic, and belief in its possibility seems to have been coeval with the genesis of humanity, which people giving it another name. Thus, theosophy is not a religion. We say, but religion itself, the one bond of unity, which is so universal and all-embracing that no man, as no speck from gods and mortals down to animals, the blade of grass and atom, can be outside of its light. Therefore, any organization or body of that name must necessarily be a universal brotherhood. From what is theosophy? And is theosophy a religion?
Thank you. The second reading is from the writings of William Q. Judge on the Theosophical Movement, and this will be read by a student from the Philadelphia lot.
From the article, The Theosophical Movement. There is a great difference between the Theosophical Movement and any Theosophical Society. The movement is moral, ethical, spiritual, universal, invisible save in effect, and continuous. A society formed for theosophical work is a visible organization, an effect, a machine for conserving energy and putting it to use. It is not, nor can it be, universal, nor is it continuous. The theosophical movement being continuous, it is to be found in all times and in all nations. Wherever thought has struggled to be free, wherever spiritual ideas, as opposed to forms and dogmatism, have been promulgated, there the great movement is to be discerned. Jacob Boehm's work was a part of it. And so also was the Theosophical Society of over 100 years ago. Luther's Reformation must be reckoned as a portion of it. And the great struggle between science and religion, clearly portrayed by Draper, was every bit as much a motion of the Theosophical movement as is the present society of that name. And among political examples of the movement is to be counted the independence of the American colonies, ending in the formation of a great nation and theoretically based on brotherhood. The second reading, each member a center. Some years ago, one of these masters in whom so many of our members believe directed HPB to write a letter for him to a certain body of theosophists. In this, he said that each member could become, in his own town or city, if earnest, sincere, and unselfish, an active center from which would radiate unseen, powerful forces able to influence men and women in the vicinity for good, and that some inquirers would appear, a branch in time, be organized, and thus the whole neighborhood would receive benefit. This seems just and reasonable. In addition to its being stated by such high authority, members ought to consider and think over it and think over it so that action may follow. Too many who think themselves theosophically alone in their own town have folded their hands and shut up their minds, saying to themselves that they could do nothing. That no one was near who could possibly care for theosophy, and that that particular town was the most difficult for the work. The great mistake in these cases is forgetting the law indicated in what HPB wrote. It is one that every member ought to know, that the mind of man is capable of bringing about results through means of other minds about him. If we sit and think that nothing can be done, then our subtle mind meets other minds within the radius of our sphere, not small, and shouts into them, nothing can be done. Of course, then, nothing is done. But if unselfishly and earnestly we think theosophy and desire that others should, like us, be benefited by it, then to the minds we meet in stray moments of the day and in many hours of the night, we cry theosophy and help and hope for thee. The result must be an awakening of interest upon the slightest provocative occasion. Such an inner attitude, added to every sort of attempt at promulgation, will disclose many unsuspected persons who are thinking along this very line. Thus will the opportunity of the hour be taken advantage of. Close up the ranks. Each member a center, each branch a center, the whole a vast whirling center of light and force and energy for the benefit of the nation and of the race.
Thank you. Third and last reading is from the writings of Robert Crosby on various aspects of ULT, and it will be read by a student from the London, Canada Lodge.
We are not concerned in seeing things, but in the awakening of the higher consciousness. For we know that Theosophy gives the knowledge of the principles that should guide its students in their public and private work. We should also be able to find explicit directions, explicit in the sense that Theosophy points the way clearly how best to serve our fellows. The basis of successful work is unity. This is the constant cry of HPB and WQJ. To be able to afford a basis for unity to individuals or organizations without demanding any relinquishment or affiliation or belief is no small thing. The Declaration of ULT does just that. It is not a theory, but a carrying out of the spirit of the messengers, paraphrasing a saying of the master. We might say, all theosophy is before you. Take what you can. The part we play, major or minor, does not concern us at all. We might say, as Judge once did, sometimes a minor agent is used by the lodge to call the attention of the greater ones to a proper course. Our work is to call attention to the true basis for among or for union among theosophists, and at the same time to set the example. People need, whether new students or old, to grasp the message of theosophy for itself, not because of belief in any person or organization. If students succeed in grasping and applying the philosophy, they will have true clairvoyance as to men, things, and methods, and their gratefulness will include all that contributed to their opportunity. This gratitude will find expression in their doing the same for others. So the effort should be get those interested in participating to associate themselves with the work and share in its responsibility, not by posultaing or arguing, but by keeping the idea before them in various ways. As with anything else, every method has to be tried, but without making the line too hard and fast. The main work is to convey ideas. Let ULT flourish on its moral alone. The work we have to do, the knowledge we have to give out, depends on no other names than those of the true teachers, HPB and WQJ. Associates must learn to look to them, to point to them, and to make the masters whom they serve. Nothing else will restore the movement. Unity is key, not of our attempt and living persons, if made prominent, will detract from the attempt, will be attacked to injure our movement. So we will keep their names out of consideration. Let the curious and antagonistic surmise all that they want to. The really earnest will then judge by the fruits, not by persons. Theosophy does not emanate from any society, nor from any living persons, so far as world or all theosophists are concerned. Theosophy comes from HPV and WQJ, or rather, through them. So, to avoid misconceptions, we get back to the living persons, to the message and the messengers. HPV once wrote, "If anyone holds a Buddha's philosophy, let him say and do as Buddha said and did. If a man calls himself a Christian, let him follow the commandments of Christ, not the interpretations of many dissenting priests and sects. The moral is, if anyone desires to be a theosophist, let him study theosophy as it was given by those who enunciated it."
Thank you. We will now hear a talk on the enduring mission of the Theosophical Movement presented by a student from the Washington, D.C. Lodge.
Friends, every great spiritual impulse in human history has had its visible beginning in time and place, and yet claimed roots that reach beyond its own era. The modern Theosophical Movement is no exception. Launched in New York City in the final quarter of the 19th century, the Theosophical Society was founded at a very moment when civilization stood suspended between a dogmatic religion it could no longer believe and a materialistic science that left little room for the soul. And into the spiritual vacuum, the founders presented to the modern world a body of teaching that was once at once a religion of universal brotherhood and a philosophy of human perfectibility. and HPB said in her very first issue of the Theosophist magazine. She said, "Theosophy is then the archaic wisdom religion, that esoteric doctrine once known in every ancient country, having claims to civilization." And in the same article, she traced the movement back through the Neoplatonists of Alexandria, all the way back to endless time. And she described, as an example, the aim of Ammonius Cyclas, the founder of the Eclectic Theosophical School, that the object was to reconcile all sects, people, and nations under one common faith, a belief in one supreme, eternal, unknown, and unnamed power, governing the universe by immutable and eternal laws, and to induce all men to lay aside their stripes and quarrels and unite in purpose and thought as children of one common mother. HPB also stated in The Secret Doctrine that the source from which these teachers drew, presenting the wisdom religion as no invention of any single mind, but as a tested and verified record covering thousands of generations of seers whose respective experiences and time were to verify the traditions passed orally by early one race to another of the teachings of higher and exalted beings who watched over the childhood of humanity. H.P. Blavatsky was a teacher, the direct agent of the masters, who gave the world several priceless gems, such as Isis Unveiled, The Secret Doctrine, and The Voice of the Silence. And Mr. Judge was a colleague, a humble mystic, who through his own publications, such as Ocean of Theosophy and his letters, applied these great doctrines to the daily life of the aspirant. Upon the passing of the founders, it was up to Crosby to rescue what could be rescued. And Crosby understood from the beginning that the mission of the ULT was nothing less than the restoration of the original program of the masters, and that the success depended on keeping personality out of the work. And he said, "We have to strike the keynote for those who come after us, and once struck, it will be followed by those who take hold. The future of the ULT on its own self-understanding is therefore to be measured by the purity with which the keynote is sustained from generation to generation. The spirit of the ULT is contained and renewed in its declaration, which is read at lodges around the world. It is drawn very largely from the writings of the founders." And we could look at three features of this document. The first is impersonality, which we just heard. The declaration names no leader, confers no office, claims no authority. In ULT work, as the mission pamphlet explains, ULT has no leaders and in the sense of authorities. Second feature we could look at is independence. In that sense, each associate must stand on his own feet. And yet this freedom is anchored in the great teachings of the founders and the message. The third feature is breadth. The large degrees of theosophists, all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, and whether they have ever heard the word theosophy or not. The spirit of the ULT is thus the spirit of a fraternity of leaders, and as the mission pamphlet puts it, the United Lodge of Theosophists are laboratories for the practical demonstration of this word in theosophy and for the development of avenues for the spread of theosophical ideas throughout the world. The bond amongst the students is thus a philosophical and not an organizational bond. And from the spirit of theosophy flows practice. Theosophy at its core is not merely a system of speculation or theory, but a power to be lived. H.V. Blavatsky herself fixed the standard in the Key to Theosophy when she said, "Members they are by virtue of the having joined the society, but the latter cannot make a theosophist of one who has no sense for the divine fitness of things, or of him who understands theosophy in his own sectarian and egotistic way." "Handsome is as handsome does" could be paraphrased in this case and be made to run "theosophist is who theosophy does." The Declaration of the ULT echoes the same standard when it regards its theosophists as all who are engaged in the truth's service of humanity. A theosophist, in other words, is defined not mere by belief or membership or just theoretical learning, but by action. And Mr. Judge said, it is not high learning that is needed, but solely devotion to humanity, faith in the masters, in the higher self, a comprehension of the fundamental truths of theosophy, and a little, only a little, sincere attempt to present these fundamental truths to a people who are in desperate need of them. So practical theosophy, then, is the movement in its living form. The metaphysics of one life becomes compassion at the bedside, honesty in business, and patience in family. The first object of the movement is to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, color, or creed. And along those lines, theosophy says emphatically that brotherhood is a fact in nature, and that is because all souls are identical in essence with the universal oversoul, and it requires us all to reorient the sense of self, and that is also called self-transformation. Mr. Judd said, so then we insist that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. It is a fact for the lowest part of nature, for the animal kingdom, for the vegetable kingdom, and the mineral kingdom. We are all atoms obeying the law together. Our denying it does not disprove it. It simply puts off the day of reward and keeps us miserable, poor, and selfish. And the masses themselves place brotherhood, and not phenomena or mere philosophy, at the heart of their own efforts. As one of them said, the term universal brotherhood is no idle phrase. It is the only secure foundation for universal morality. If it be a dream, it is at least a noble one for mankind, and it is the aspiration of a true adept. Universal brotherhood is not possible without self-transformation. In the Key to Theosophy, HPB writes that removing the natural impulse of selfishness, which is deeply entrenched in human nature, is a first step towards making universal brotherhood a reality in society. Selfishness is abolished only in the individual heart by the individual will. And this is why every scheme of external reform that leaves human nature untouched has failed and must fail. HPB goes on to state the only ground on which the cure can rest, declaring that theosophy alone can eradicate the perversity of selfish doctrine by demonstrating on logical, philosophical, metaphysical, and even scientific grounds that A, all men have spiritually and physically the same origin, which is the fundamental teaching of theosophy, and B, as mankind is essentially of one and the same essence, that essence is one, infinite, uncreate, and eternal, whether we call it God or nature. Nothing therefore that can affect one nation or one individual without affecting all other nations and all other individuals. This is as certain and as obvious as a stone thrown into a pond, sooner or later, set into motion every single drop of water therein. If self-transformation is a requirement, spiritual self-regeneration points to the process by which we could accomplish this. The ULT mission pamphlet states as follows: by means of study, inquirers come to recognize and try to avoid repeating the tragic failures of great religious movements of the past. Serious moral reform requires a light of understanding on the processes of self-generation and an awareness of how human weakness combines with ignorance to produce partisanship. The high ends of altruism and brotherhood cannot be realized without deep insight into the laws of human development and a grasp where the major obstacles to these lie. So then, what is being regenerated? Theosophy answers by saying that the relation between the personal man and the higher self, The personal man, from the theosophical point of view, is merely a bundle of bodily habits, desires, and mental patterns built up by ages of selfish living. Spiritual self-regeneration is a deliberate and conscious reversal of that pattern, the gradual transfer of the sense of identity from the perishable mask to the immortal thinker, until the personality becomes an instrument of the soul instead of its prison. The secret doctrine describes the soul's ascent first by natural impulse and then by self-induced and self-devised efforts checked by his karma, thus ascending through all degrees of intelligence from the lowest to the highest madhas. The phrase self-induced, self-devised efforts can be considered synonymous with the quest for self-regeneration. No savior, no sacrament, no organization can substitute for them. Each pilgrim must do it for himself or herself. How do we attain this? Essentially, we are told, essentially it is turning inward. It is a grand quest. In the grand quest, it is the endeavor to reach up to the self within, and in that regard could be considered a form of a sacred obligation. The second is self-study. And as it has been stated, theosophical students see self-study and meditation as two sides of the same coin. Both require perspectives beyond the personal. The third is altruistic action, the practice of theosophy, without which the other two descend into selfishness. And HPB, in the first article, summoned the testimony of the Neoplatonist, and she quoted Porphyry as this: to unite one's soul to the universal soul requires but a perfectly pure mind. Through self-contemplation, perfect chastity, and purity of body, we may approach nearer to it and receive in that state true knowledge and wonderful insight. The indispensable role of self-regeneration is therefore in the establishment of the true universal brotherhood. It is essentially the cultivation of right perception. Each sees the other, the same one self he is uncovered within himself. Each small step of true meditation, every selfish motive detected and renounced, every act of unrewarded service is a brick, no matter how small the brick, in the foundation of the brotherhood of a man. It is important to also understand that self-regeneration cannot be accomplished in one short life and without an innate understanding of the twin doctrines of karma and reincarnation. They are indicated in the third or three fundamental propositions of the secret doctrine, which says the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, the latter being itself an aspect of the unknown root, and the obligatory pilgrimage of every soul is spark of the former through the cycle of incarnation or necessity in accordance with cyclic and karmic law during the whole term. The pivotal doctrine of esoteric philosophy admits no privileges or special gifts in man, save those were won by his own ego through personal effort and merit throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. And these twin doctrines rest in turn upon the second fundamental proposition, which is the universal law of cycles, stated in the secret doctrine as the absolute universality of the law of periodicity, of flux and reflux, ebb and flow, which physical science has observed and recorded in all departments of nature. An alternation such as that of day and night, life and death, sleeping and waking, is a fact so common, so perfectly universal and without exception, that it is easy to comprehend that in it we see one of the absolutely fundamental laws of the universe. And reincarnation is simply this law applied to the soul. As day follows night and waking follows sleep, so birth follows death, by no special miracle, by the same rhythm that swings the tides and the seasons. Karma is a law of moral causation. The carrying of cause into effect on every plane. Its human moral equivalent is expressed in the Bible with the phrase, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap." And again, with emphasis on its harmonizing function, it is stated as follows. While there is an inherent harmony in the universal soul, as individuals, we have the free will to deviate from that harmony in thought, word, and action. And karma is a name given to that law which counterbalances the effects of such deviations, thus restoring universal harmony. It restores justice. Reincarnation, we are taught, is karma's necessary companion. Again, it's told, reincarnation is a companion of doctrine of karma, pointing to the immense pilgrimage of the soul in its journey to self-realization. The cycle of incarnation is of one birth and death, and life never stops. Consciousness persists. Causes put in one place in one life are borne out in future incarnations. One life is far too short to accomplish all that a soul yearns to do. The soul is given not merely 70 years or a few years, but a whole term of the pilgrimage to learn every lesson that manifested universe can teach. Upon these two principles, the higher life is founded. The higher life is not a religious life in a conventional sense, nor a life of withdrawal from the world. It is human existence, consciously centered around the reality of the immortal soul and the law that governs its growth. He who identifies himself with his transient personality lives with that personality. He lives for comfort, acquisition of wealth and power and reputation, and this is a lower life. And is also referred to as a womb of pain in the Dhammapada. It's bound to cycle of death and rebirth. On the other hand, he who knows himself an evolving pilgrim, reaping today what was sowed in former lives, and sowing today what must be reaped in lives to come, has an entirely different set of motives, responsibility, patience, and purpose. The higher life, then, is a life lived in the light of karma and reincarnation, a life in which every thought is recognized as a cause, every circumstance as an effect, every neighbor as a fellow pilgrim, and every day as one more stage in a journey whose end is conscious union with the higher self of all. It is at once the fruit of self-regeneration and its sustaining motive, and it binds the individual destiny to the destiny of the race. Now, in a few days, we will be celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States. It might be a good time to draw some parallels between the declaration of the ULT and that of independence, our Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists has for its heart a single end, and that is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It is a declaration of principles and not of an organization, of a basis of union and not mere articles of belief. And in this, it has a remarkable parallel in American history. On July 4, 1776, another declaration was adopted, which likewise refused to ground human association in power, lineage, or creed, and grounded itself in self-evident truth. And here's what it says. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, and these amongst these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The kinship between the ULT Declaration and the Declaration of Independence is not accidental, and the Theosophical movement itself acknowledged it from the beginning. And here's what we see in the first issue of the Theosophists, where HPB says about the society, about Theosophical society. Born in the United States of America, the society was constituted on the model of its motherland. The latter, omitting the name of God from its constitution, lest it should afford a pretext one day to make a state religion, gives absolute equality to all religions and its laws. All support, and each is in turn protected by the state. The society modeled upon this constitution may fairly be termed as Republic of Conscience. And if we read this in the light of theosophy, the famous sentence in the 1776 Declaration of Independence discloses depths its drafters perhaps were not even aware of. All men are created equal, it states, and theosophy alone supplies the foundation on which the proposition can be understood to be true. The third fundamental proposition of the secret doctrine declares the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul. Individuals are equal, not in the personalities which karma has differentiated, but equal in the inner essence, which is one. Every soul is a spark of the same flame, albeit it at a different stage of the same pilgrimage, and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, as the Declaration says, and these rights are precisely stated so because they are not granted by state or society or majority, but they are inherent in the very divine nature of the soul itself. What no government gives, no government can rightfully take away. And we could therefore infer that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness can translate in theosophical terms into the soul's right to this pilgrimage, the freedom of self-induced and self-divided effort, without which no spiritual growth is possible. And the quest for enduring felicity, which is found only in the union with the higher self, and which we are taught is the self of all. The first sentence of the Declaration of Independence is thus, in germ or in concept, a statement of the first and third fundamental propositions of the ancient wisdom religion, and this great American experiment may fairly be called an attempt to found a nation upon universal brotherhood, a republic of conscience. These lofty ideals are still to be realized, and theosophy alone offers the path towards that realization. The third fundamental teaches the ascension by self-induced and self-devised efforts. What is true of the individual soul is true of the collective soul, which is a nation. America was carried to the threshold by its ideals by impulse from its founders, and as a nation, it can cross that threshold only as the individual soul crosses every threshold by self-induced and self-devised efforts, collectively willed and patiently sustained. No external power will bring to fruition the precepts in the Declaration of Independence. No single generation can. The nation must regenerate itself, as the individual must, by facing its own past karma honestly, by renouncing the doctrine of separateness in all its forms, and by laboring generation after generation to make the equality of souls a fact of law. The unfinished Declaration of Independence is thus, for theosophy, a national exercise in the very discipline of self-transformation as the sole road to brotherhood. So then what of the future of theosophy? The theosophical movement on its own teaching is not merely a 19th century phenomenon, but a perpetual presence in history, flowing now through one channel and now through a different channel. Its visible organizations are mere instruments of an impulse that antedates and outlasts them all. Its future is never in doubt. What is in question is only the readiness of men and women and institutions to serve it. The teachings of theosophy aim to soften dogmatism, widen tolerance, and make the language of human solidarity the common speech of mankind, however imperfect that practice. The full work of the lodge is far ahead. Wherever the sense of separateness breeds war, exploitation, and despair, the theosophical teachings strive to address the cause and not merely the symptoms. And despair, the theosophical, for as has been shown throughout the world, troubles of the world can be traced to karma, or the practice of separateness, and the cure is realized fact of brotherhood. The upliftment of humanity in the theosophical sense is not just a redistribution of comforts, but a regeneration of inner consciousness, accomplished like all regeneration by self-induced and self-devised efforts, one soul at a time. The instruments of that future are already at hand. The recorded teachings of H.P. Blavatsky, of Mr. Judge, Crosby, and the Masters, guarded in the purity by the United Lodge of Theosophists, awaits each new generation of students. The keynote struck by Robert Crosby, who said, "We have to strike the keynote for those who come after us, and once struck, it will be followed by those who take hold." The Lodge asks for no converts and counts no members. It only asks for those who try, just try, to desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. And in conclusion, we conclude with a few words from Mr. Judge, who said, "Live with each other as brothers, for the misery and the trouble of the world are of more importance than all the scientific progress that may be imagined. I conclude by calling upon you, all that humanity holds dear, to remember what I say, and whether Christians, atheists, Jews, pagans, heathen, or theosophists, try to practice universal brotherhood, which is the universal duty of all men." Thank you for listening.
Thank you. So it's traditional that on ULT Day, we'll close the formal part of our meeting with a reading of the United Lodge of Theosophists Declaration, which goes like this. "The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. Without professing attachment to any theosophical organization, it is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles, a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all." That's the close of our formal part of our meeting. And then for the informal part, we'll make a few announcements and allow a few minutes for people to share their favorite quotations from Robert Crosby, or to tell us about their feelings about ULT and Mr. Crosby. As for announcements, the question might come up sometimes. People ask, how do you become a member of ULT? And the answer is, one signs what's called an associate card. looks like this. And this card just has written, it has the theosophical symbol on it, and it has these words: being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. You write your name and you sign it and you submit it, and that's how you become a member. Where do you find such a card? If you ask some of the people who've been knocking around in your lodge for a while, they will surely be able to direct you. And the second announcement is that, as many of you may have heard, there's a new edition of The Secret Doctrine, Madame Blavatsky's great work. And this is a new edition, not a new version. Nothing essential has been changed. As it said on the website where you can find it, it's been carefully prepared with verified quotations and corrected references, while preserving the structure and pagination of the original 1888 edition. This can be purchased at theosophyult.com or Amazon. And there is a digital version. This is really quite extraordinary. The whole thing has been digitized. You can go to this, anybody, for free, and put in a control F, find, control find, look up any word, put a word in there, evolution or karma or manvantara or palaya, any word, and it'll take you right there. And if you want to find another one, just press the return and you go to the next one and the next one. And you can even copy and paste it if you want to put it on your, write a paper on the subject. And that digital version can be found socialtheosophy.com. Third and last announcement, the reminder of many of you have heard, there will be in this area, there is a summer theosophical gathering in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, on Saturday, July 11th. Again, if you ask around and people in your lodge, they'll be able to tell you more information about that. Now, for a few minutes, if you like, we can extend the meeting's supposed to end in 2 minutes, but we'll extend it a few if you like. And if you'd like to share a quotation from Robert Crosby, from the writings of Robert Crosby, we'd love to hear it. If you just want to express your feelings about ULT or about Mr. Crosby, we'd like to hear that too. So if you just raise your hand, I guess your digital hand, and we'll call on you as those hands arise.
We have two hands, Hal,
Yes.
Theosophy Hall and Judy.
Okay.
Now, this quote from Robert Crosby attracts my attention. All sincere students are surrounded by an invisible escort as long as their faces are set towards the goal and they remain staunch to the master's program.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Is that Judy?
Yes, this is not a quote, but a comment. I very much like the analogy about the foundation of the ULT and the founding of the United States. I mean, most of the founders were Masons, which was the theosophy of the 18th century. In our dollar bill, there is a pyramid which is separated with an eye looking like the eye of Dongmo, which is apparently a symbolism in masonry, and it says, "Annuit coeptis novus ordo sacrorum." The heavens decree the new order of the world. But of course, we know at the moment it has failed. And even initially, although Adams was for it, they failed to get rid of the heinous institution of slavery because Jefferson knew we couldn't fight the British without the South. So we had to keep that, and that wasn't changed until many years later. And of course, we're still fighting racist institutions in this country. But I think the idea of brotherhood is very much in the Constitution, in that there is no state religion. There isn't any kind of a focus on any one race or ethnicity. Our Constitution is really welcoming of immigrants. If you're born in the United States, you're American. And of course, the attempts to change these are going to be met with a great deal of opposition, I hope. But the promise of America really is the same promise of Theosophy, but is far from being fulfilled at the moment. So we're going to have to work very hard for it. Thank you.
Thank you. The close connection between the American Revolution and Theosophy is brought out in a wonderful article by Mr. Judge called
Deaths in America in
the 70, yes, the
1776.
Deaths in America in 1776. Are we getting a lot of feedback? Okay, it's because I have the headphones on. Yes, great, thank you. Laura?
Well, we would like to indicate that there is no failure. What we see right now is like the lotus seed that has been planted in the mud. And so, what we're seeing in America is a process of germination, but it's not only confined to America, it is worldwide. There are Americans all over the world who belong to every country who are watching and working towards the germination of this ideal. And so, we cannot give up at all, but this and recognize that it's part of a process. And in regards to that, one of my favorite quotes from the friendly philosopher on true religion, and is a reminder that those beings, those teachers are above us on this ladder of evolution, who are greater than any gods we can conceive of, passed through the very same trials that we are now going through. So this is not new. And it says here, they had the same suffering which we are now undergoing until they learn to know their innermost nature and to act in accordance with it. And so that innermost nature is exemplified in the ideal of universal brotherhood. So these ideas have been planted in the soil of America, and they are in the process of germinating. So, we cannot give up. We must just keep on until, as Walt Whitman said, everyone is lovers like we are.
Brethren and lovers as we are.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Canadian, for the need all the support we could get. Okay.
Beautiful.
Anyone else like to share some a reading or some thoughts? I have one. We know that there are some terrible wars going on in the world now and a lot of suffering through them. There was a terrible war going on during the early years of the ULT between 1914 and 1918. It was what was then called the Great War, which later we now call World War I. It ended officially on November 11th, 1918. Mr. Crosby would be pass away the following June of 1919. And when the war was ending, there was an outcry, how can we prevent this from happening again? This terrible, terrible scourge that affected the whole world. and people proposed economic solutions and political solutions and religious solutions. And Mr. Crosby wrote an article. One of the ideas was to establish what was called the League of Nations, the kind of precursor of the United Nations. And in response to this, Mr. Crosby wrote an article, gave a talk, which became an article called A League of Humanity. And it's a wonderful dissection of these alternative approaches for solving the problem and what the real solution is, which is, of course, theosophy. And a very small portion of this wonderful article reads, "The war of this or any time is the result of the warring spirit of the selfishness of mankind. It is the result of the failure to understand the great purpose of life, the nature of our minds, the full power of attainment within each being, the one law of absolute justice inherent in all beings, the one deity behind and in all, the one God for every pilgrim, however the path varies. As soon as men are brought to the perception that everyone reaps exactly what he sows, no one will do harm to any other being. There will then be no war. There will be no such misery as now exists. For to realize our own responsibility to others and to act in accordance is to have become unselfish and to have done away with the prime cause of sin, sorrow, and suffering." That's why our work is so important. The real problems are deep, and the solution has to be deep. Well, I think
SL? SL had his hand up earlier.
Oh, yeah.
SL?
SL?
Yes. Thank you. This quote was passed along to me by an associate who's joining us on phone. And so we will read it on our behalf. And we think it maybe takes into account the difficult task at hand, but also simplifies it. What can we do right now, every one of us? And this is from Robert Crosby. "Let us resolve one thing. Resolve to know, think right, and do right. Resolve to acquire some of the knowledge that has always existed, the knowledge of man as a spiritual being through all his fluctuations in the realm of matter."
Great. Thank you. I think then we'll bring the meeting to a close. Thank you all for coming, participants and attendees alike. We couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we've all...
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're all Thank inspired, you. That's for
yes.
sure.
Yes.
Thank
you.
Very good.
Thank you.
So very much.
Oh, thank good you night. For thank inspiring you. Talk.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right, friends.
Bye.
Okay.